Hello and welcome to Intrepid Times, your home for narrative travel writing with heart. I'm Nathan Thomas, and alongside my co-host Jennifer Roberts, we take you behind the scenes of some of our most popular travel stories, get you to meet travel writers, and help you discover how you can share your own travel stories with the world. Hello and welcome to the Intrepid Times Travel Writing Podcast. This is Nathan Thomas with a rare solo episode. Normally it's my co-editor Jennifer Roberts and myself, or one of us is interviewing a guest, normally a travel author with a book out or someone with an interesting perspective or experience on the genre. But this week, for a variety of circumstances, it's just me. It's not something I plan to make a habit out of, but I'm going to take the opportunity to deep dive into a topic that I think about a lot, and as someone who lives in the age of the internet and who clearly is interested in travel writing, whether as a reader, a writer, an aspiring writer, or some form of all of the above, you probably think about too, and that is the simple question: has the internet ruined travel writing? Certainly it has been a boom for the so-called travel bloggers, those who talk about the best cocktail bars in Barcelona and talk about their experience going here or there. Many of them have audiences of millions, and many of them are very entertaining and quite useful. I read several. But they're not normally what we think of when we mean travel writing. So what's the difference? On a surface level, I suppose, not much. They're both literally narrating a trip. But I suppose the difference is stylistic, and it's hard to talk about this without sounding snobby or pretentious, and that's not what I'm trying to do here. A lot of travel bloggers create great writing, but the incentives that drive their work, and these are incentives that none of us who publish online in any form are immune from, are not the incentives to produce great writing. That is not what they're rewarded for. They're not rewarded for depth or insight or scintillating prose. They're rewarded by an algorithm created by Google, which through various complicated means, many of which nobody really understands, decides which stories are going to be at the top of the list for which search terms. And if you can get your article on the top five cocktail bars in Barcelona, or the cheapest way to book a flight, or the quickest train from Tokyo to Kyoto at the top of that list, then you're going to get a lot of visitors to your blog, to your website, and you're probably going to make a lot of money. So this is what is exerting pressure on those who write about travel topics. After all, everybody needs to make a living, and if you decide to make your living through your passion for travel, and you decide that writing is the tool by which you're going to do it, that's one of the best ways and remains one of the best ways to do so. And the writing about guides, the giving instructional information or sharing experience in a way that is designed to be helpful and informative, is an extremely contemporary thing. These pieces of writing are probably not going to be useful or even interesting in a year or even 6 months sometimes, but they're not designed to be. They're designed to help people with a particular goal or problem in a particular circumstance, and you're sharing your insight through research or personal experience to help them do so. And through my career in travel writing, I've written many travel guides for books and for many websites. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's kind of an essential way to get the bread and butter from this work. And even today, many of the top travel writers whose name you'll see on the spines of books in Barnes & Noble and Waterstones still do that kind of work because it pays for the trip. But that's not really what I mean by travel literature. The ones who are successful know the difference. They know when they're wearing their SEO, search engine optimization hat, and deciding to go for the keywords that will allow them to be rewarded for a piece of writing. And they know when they're stepping back, feeling the inner voice, deciding what something really meant, deciding what they really feel about it, looking below the surface and just trusting to the voice and telling the story. And it's very hard to do both things. And if you're someone who can only do the second thing, Which, by the way, probably defines most great writers over time. They never had to think about this first half. Then it's probably quite hard to get established now. So this is part of what I'm talking about with the internet ruining travel writing to an extent by exerting a certain pressure, a certain influence on writers to optimize their work to please algorithms and search engines rather than to listen to some abstract, deeper goal that I'm not going to try too hard to define because any attempt to define it will sound outrageously pretentious. But I think you know what I mean here. And of course, this whole thing with SEO dovetails into the whole social media conversation where the incentives are perverse. You're rewarded for aligning yourself with a particular tribal view and echoing the beliefs of that tribe so that you get supported, or by being deliberately provocative and controversial so that you become the center of a conversation. Neither of these things are the soul of great literature or great writing. Of course, much great literature and writing has been tribal or provocative, but these incentives are not what push you to think deeper, to care more, to really go inside of yourself. So how do you, as someone who cares about the genre, deal with that? I gave kind of an example before where I spoke about the successful travel writers who become adept at wearing two hats and traveling knowing that they're going to tell two stories. They're going to keep, as they said about the writer Christopher Hitchens, or as he said about himself, keep two sets of books. One set of book as the person who is active in the commercial space of the modern travel writer, who knows how to perform keyword research on Google, who knows what editors care about, what people are searching for, what's going to be profitable. And the other set of books is for the real observations, the story, the personal connection, the chance encounter, the strange conversation. Keeping those two sets of books, maybe merging them if you get the opportunity to. At Intrepid Times, we're mostly on the second set of books, but we allow something to drip forward from the first as well. That's one way to function. But the other kind of idea of the internet and travel writing is something that I started thinking about recently. I don't know if you have this experience, you probably do, when you surround yourself with books that you have been meaning to read. You tell yourself you want to read them, but in reality, you just feel like you should read them. You don't actually want to read them, but you want to have read them. You want to have them as information in your brain, and you want to be able to tell yourself, and let's be honest, others, that you've read them. And I was in a state where I surrounded myself with these quite dense, heavy history books about Poland and other places, which are fascinating, and I will get through, but I just found myself not reading during my leisure time. So I wanted to get back into the habit of reading, and I wanted to pick up something that was a light read because I've been doing a lot of writing, and at the end of a long day writing, I often don't feel like reading anything challenging, but also useful and compelling and in the space that we live and work in. And I reached for a book that was the first book that really got me into this world of travel writing, and I'm sure many people listening to this can relate, which is Paul Theroux's 2008 book, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star. Now, this is an interesting starting point for Paul Theroux, because Paul wrote that book in his late 60s about a trip that he did when he was 66, retracing the route that he took at the age of 33 in the 70s when he wrote his breakout travel book, The Great Railway Bazaar. I'd read the books kind of in the wrong order, the opposite order to which the author lived and traveled them. And at the start of the later book, Ghost Stranger of the Eastern Star, Paul Theroux kind of brings you into the kind of person he was, or the world that he was living in. When he wrote the first book, he talks about how his first book, which was his great triumph, it sold 1.5 million copies when it came out. This huge thing, and it's been said to have, in 1975, The Great Railway Bazaar, to have reinvigorated travel writing as a genre. And remember, it was only 2 years later, in 77, that Bruce Chatwin came out with his great book in Patagonia. I believe Patrick Leigh Fermor's A Time of Gifts was also published in the second half of the 70s after The Great Railway Bazaar. So it was a huge triumph for Paul, for the genre. It's a wonderful read. And Paul seems quite cheerful when he writes about the book. I mean, Paul Theroux has never, a particularly overly upbeat or positive writer. He grumbles and he teases, but for his standards, and overall, you get the impression of a mostly happy person behind the pages. It's certainly quite a funny book, but as Thoreau tells you in the subsequent book, the one done when he was double that age, actually, he wasn't so happy. He was blocked creatively as a writer, and his domestic life was falling apart, and he had a wife and a small child, and the wife had begged him not to go on that trip. He went anyway and came back to find, to paraphrase Paul, to find that he had been replaced, and the wife had taken up with another gentleman in his stead. So he describes how, and I can't remember if this was in the first book or as he's talking about it or in the second book as he's looking back, but Paul describes how as he was doing that original journey in the 70s, riding from by train from London across Asia and the Middle East, there were many days and weeks when no one back home knew where he was. He would send postcards, but of course they would take a long time to get delivered, postcards and letters. He called home, I think he says, just twice on that trip. And calling was something that, you know, you'd have to go to the hotel and use a payphone to do. You'd have to try and coordinate the times. There was no constant connectivity of the type that we have now. And that's something that I personally, being closer to the age that Paul was when he wrote the first book rather than the second, have very little memory of. The idea of traveling without that link tethering you to everybody else, everyone else who knows you, everyone who might want something from you, people who are wishing you well, people who might be wishing you otherwise, all of your obligations, your normal world, your universe of daily life and normal obligations. You carry that with you everywhere. And I'm a particularly bad example of this, answering work emails on overnight trains in India or on Ferris wheels in Georgia. Part of these are habits and choices that you can make to insulate yourself from them. But part of it is that if that option exists to check in with people, you're eventually going to want to use it. And it's very hard to train yourself not to. And if that option exists for others to check in with you, they're going to do so. And I had to kind of cast my mind back to my very first independent travels, which were in the early 2000s when smartphones were still not completely ubiquitous, when you would check into a youth hostel and they would give you a paper map. And being guided by that paper map, you'd wander and you'd see the sights, and then you'd fold it up, hopefully put it in the pocket and go and get lost, and then you'd take it out again and look at the names of the streets and try and hold the map up sideways and try and figure out where on earth you are. And of course now we all just use a GPS, and I don't think that's necessarily a worse way of travel now, but it is definitely different. And with all that we've gained in terms of convenience, we've lost something, and perhaps it's similar to the first problem, the incentives making us go for the surface level of things so that we get those search engine clicks and social media likes, that immediate accessibility of information. And when you're constantly being pulled out of the moment to deal with distractions back home, to update people, to be updated on things, when you have that constant link that is never severed, the depths of things get a little bit lost as well. You're sitting in the cafe and your attention is hijacked by your phone and you're not really observing or listening, or perhaps because of the convenience offered to you by the information that you have, you don't actually end up getting lost. You find yourself conveniently the Uber, the hotel, you go to the restaurant with the good reviews, you avoid getting yourself in a ridiculous situation that might have been unpleasant, might have been a bad meal, might have been a long train journey rather than a quick taxi ride, might have been a wrong turn down the wrong street, which would have been troublesome at the time, but ultimately would have made the best story. But because you were armed with that immediate access to all the information in the world, you avoid it. And I'm thinking very much of myself and my own experiences as well when I talk about this. And it's very hard not to use that power. You can simply say, well, then just, you know, turn your phone off when you travel. But are you really going to do that? Certainly in my experience, I haven't. And this leads to a slightly scarier question, which is that if everywhere you go, You're still constantly connected to everyone you know, every obligation you have, every piece of information that keeps you as yourself. Are you really traveling at all? I mean, one of the great things about travel, particularly when you're young, is that you can kind of reinvent yourself when you meet new people. They don't know who you are, your backstory, who your personality is. And it's not like you're trying to cover up some deep, dark secret or pass yourself off as a millionaire or a scammer like William Bakeland allegedly did. And we have a podcast touching on that. It's more like maybe if you were shy at home, you'd try and be extroverted and just see if that suits you. Probably it won't, but you try something or you try and emphasize a different part of your actual true history just to see how that feels. Or maybe you disguise some aspects of your personality in order to get more information and make people feel more comfortable. Certainly, I didn't go around emphasizing my Jewish origins when I was traveling in the Middle East. And this allows you to make people feel more comfortable and learn more. It's really travel because you're not who you were when you're back home. But of course, these days, if you meet someone, you exchange social media, that entire world is immediately there. And that entire world is constantly in your pocket. I suppose this is the dark side of the digital nomad thing. And of course, I've lived the digital nomad life for a decade. I wrote about how it is done, or how it was done in my case, in my most recent book, Untethered: Living the Digital Nomad Life in an Uncertain World, available on Amazon and where good books are sold. And that is a positive and a negative. The positive, of course, is that many of us, including myself, couldn't just travel constantly if we weren't able to support ourselves whilst being on the road. And being online allows us to do that. It also means that we can keep in touch with friends and family. You don't feel really lonely. And that's great, but also feeling lonely whilst traveling has a certain depth to it, doesn't it? It connects you with something. So I am quite conscious that with all of this gain in independence, in convenience, in access, in power in a lot of ways, there's a loss, or at least a risk of a loss of depth. I don't know if there's really anything tactically that can be done about it. We've spoken about how it's mostly futile to simply put your phone away, because you're not really going to, and maybe you can train yourself to, but are you really going to? Or if you are, it's a temporary thing. And when it comes to making a living as a travel writer, you may scoff at the incentives to get your piece on the front page of Google, but you're unlikely to be paid, certainly not paid well, if there isn't an audience for your writing, and that's where the audience is. They're still Googling stuff, at least for now. So these pressures and incentives exist. We are out there in a world which has the stuff on our shoulders. I think the only thing to do really is to be aware of it, to keep those two sets of books as a travel writer, the immediate commercial online or very online set, and also the other one, the deeper one, to wearily acknowledge the vibrating of your phone in your pocket, to dutifully fulfill your work and keep friends and family up to date and enjoy that connectivity, and yes, call the Uber, but also to sometimes decide not to look up the route on Google Maps, to not call that Uber, to not look up reviews of that restaurant on the corner filled with the locals drinking raki and smoking cigarettes at 10 a.m., but to just go in, to be aware of what it means to be a travel writer in 2024, with all of the opportunities, but also all of the pressures and perils of being online. And when you're writing with that second set of books, the set of books that is not governed by all of these incentives, it is just you, think of them, to use Jim Harrison's phrase, as flowers for the void, if you have to, something that is being beautifully created from you and put out there for its own sake, even if no one sees it. And of course, be sure to submit your stories to places like Intrepid Times, that really value stories that come from that second set of books. Okay, this has been an unusual solo podcast, just a short one. Probably we won't be repeating the format. Jennifer is back soon, and we have so many exciting guests, wonderful travel authors coming up. And we'll see you on our next episode in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening. Let us know what you think. And if you haven't, speaking of being online as a travel writer, gotten hold of that book, Untethered, go to intrepidtimes.com/books, pick up a copy, leave a review. Speaking of being online, right? It really does make a huge difference. This is the world we live in. Like it or not.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen. Don't forget to join us in 2 weeks for another exciting episode of the Travel Writing Podcast. See you next time.